We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 19, Harry's Fantastic Fandom. For joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Marianne Martens about the unique characteristics of the Harry Potter fandom. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of religion and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Emily, you are part of a few fan communities.
I like to think so.
You know, not only Harry Potter, but Star Wars, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Would you say fan communities are in general going through some complicated times at the moment? Being euphemistic.
Like we all are. I think it's in one sense, it's just a fabulous time to be a fan. Because there's so much, you know, wonderful new content coming out, at least in all of my fandoms. Even Tolkien, you know, we've got a new Amazon show coming out. And Star Wars is just, you know, handing us just gem after gem, in my opinion. But I do think that the same, you know, cultural, social shifts, technological innovations that have made life in outside of fandoms challenging. You know, with polarization and things like that, I think those are also definitely deeply affecting fandoms. It's just tough, especially with the pandemic forcing us all behind screens. You know, for almost all our interactions, for some of us, it's just, you know, it's difficult to, you know, kind of foster the sort of civility that we know, you know, comes from being face to face with somebody and being in the same room as somebody and sharing the same environment with somebody. So I do. What do you think, Katie?
Yeah, no, I really, I agree with you there. And that wasn't exactly where I thought you were going to take it. But I'm on that point. I feel like when you're communicating online, it's easy to get, I think of it as like road rage. It's easy to forget there are people behind.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, you know, it's just you, somehow the rage builds up and you don't realize, you're not thinking of the person on the other end as a person. And so much of fan communities, you know, we do carry things out digitally, but we mix it up with also meeting in person and, you know, festivals and those kinds of things. And when you don't have those to balance it out, maybe it can get bad. But you know, I think about how I was just reading some about that new show, Rings of Power, for the Lord of the Rings, and that there's just been some real nastiness about the casting. And, you know, you can just see that these are issues that are plaguing fan communities. And like you said, it's really just because we're also all living in the same society.
Yeah.
That's experiencing something similar. And you've got these forces that are trying to, you know, trying to mold their fan experience in a particular way that not everybody agrees with. And there's a feeling that they'll lose it if some fans are thinking about it, you know, a more diverse cast, I'll lose my fan experience that I've built so much on.
Exactly. When somebody else comes up, it necessarily pushes somebody else down, which I don't think is true at all myself. Mm-hmm. Or I don't think people understand that, you know, if somebody else gets a larger slice of the pie, that doesn't mean that you get less of the pie. The pie grows. When everybody gets a bigger slice, the pie keeps growing, which is, you know, that's kind of my philosophy. And I stay willfully ignorant to a lot of it, Katie. If people out there hear me say something and go, well, she's obviously not heard about this YouTuber who says, and yeah, I definitely haven't heard about that YouTuber, and I don't care what they what they say. I'm an Enneagram 8. I don't care. So, but, you know, the other thing I think that complicates fan communities is the changing relationship with the creator of that fandom. So for Tolkien fans, Tolkien is dead. Tolkien's been dead, you know, for a long time. And so it's difficult to know what Tolkien would say. I mean, there are some experts who can predict probably pretty well, you know, what Tolkien would say. And we may not like it. You know, it may not solve the debate. It may be quite offensive what Tolkien would say.
Yeah,
you know?
He's an early 20th century guy.
So, right. Yeah. White male. And you know, then there's George Lucas, who is meant to have moved on from Star Wars, but occasionally chimes in a problematic way and sometimes in a fun way, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there's J.K. Rowling.
Oh, we know what she thinks about everything.
Right, exactly. And it's a complicating factor as well. So I think all three of those scenarios, you know, kind of show you the spectrum of how fan relationships with the creator can really complicate the fandom community and the way it relates to itself.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking much more about all of this today on the podcast. And helping us to understand the Harry Potter universe today is our expert, Dr. Marianne Martins, Associate Professor at the School of Information at Kent State University, and thus a fellow Ohioan. Ohio!
Woo! Part of it all.
She has a focus on youth services librarianship, and is particularly interested in the interrelation of youth readers, their libraries, and those who publish for them. She is the author of Publishers, Readers, and Digital Engagement, Participatory Forums, and Young Adult Publishing. That's from Palgrave. And today we're going to talk to her about her really fascinating book, The Forever Fandom of Harry Potter, from Cambridge University Press. Welcome to the show, Marianne.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
First of all, I just want to say how much I really enjoyed your book, The Forever Fandom of Harry Potter. And I do like the Forever Fandom.
Thank you so much.
Same.
Well, hopefully we'll get to why I named it that
A
little later. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. And, you know, for those of you out there, this is in the Cambridge Elements series. So it's a small book, but wow, is it packed with all kinds of things, Marianne. And I felt like I was reading about myself as I was reading it. And so I just connected with it a lot. So we're just delighted
that's so awesome.
To have you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So tell us, first of all, how did you encounter the Harry Potter books and what made you take a scholarly look at them?
Well, I have kind of an unusual connection to the Harry Potter books, perhaps. So prior to my academic career, I worked in children's publishing in New York City. And I remember the buzz when Arthur Levine at Scholastic, who was a young editor at the time, won the first Harry Potter book in auction from Bloomsbury, UK. And I got an advanced review copy of the book. And right away, I could just tell this was really something special. And so subsequently, I read the other books too. But, you know, I was an adult. My first child was born in 1995. So when the first book came out in the US in 1998, he was, you know, pretty young to be reading Harry Potter. But throughout his childhood, and then my second son's childhood, my second son was born in 1999, the books and the movies were very much prevalent. In the book, I talk about the Harry Potter generation. And I talk about that as young people born sort of around the time between 80 and 86, sort of coinciding with Harry Potter's age and everything else, because those people really like grew up with the books. And you can sort of, you know, plus or minus a bunch of years there as well. Besides that, you know, my kids definitely were very into Harry Potter growing up. It was a big part of our family. We would drive down to Florida often to visit my mother-in-law, and we would be listening to an audiobook version, and they're fabulous. If you haven't heard those, they're really good. And, you know, my kids really, the other really interesting thing that the way that Harry Potter had a place in my family is that my husband grew up in El Salvador, and reading was not a big part of his life at all. And so he was, you know, kind of ironic because obviously, you know, I was always a huge reader and a librarian and a publisher and a writer now and everything else. So books are such a big part of my life. But I would say that reading Harry Potter with the kids was something that really got my husband very interested in reading. So that was really sweet.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was really bummed when everybody kind of like got to read on their own and didn't want him reading with them anymore. So that was really cute.
I relate to that. I relate to that a lot.
Yeah. And you know, those books really are, you know, both of my children started reading big fat books because of Harry Potter, like so many other children of their generation. And just seeing the boost of literacy skills all around has been a lot of fun. That said, how I encountered the books, how I then got onto the scholarly side of the books. I worked in publishing for many years, and then I got my MLIS degree online through the University of Illinois. And then from there, I ended up going to Rutgers for a PhD. And while I was in the PhD program at Rutgers, of course, I was very interested in librarianship and reading and publishing and all the same kinds of things I'm interested in now. And I was particularly interested in reader response theory. If you think about, you know, Louise Rosenblatt and Wolfgang Iser and transactional theories of reading. And I was very interested in studying readers. And historically, it's been very difficult to study readers. I mean, people look at marginalia and they look at some, like Janice Radway looked at, you know, book clubs and other things. But participatory online reading sites, wow, I mean, that is a fun way to study reading and to see young people's response to things. So I was really interested in how young people were engaging online with the books they loved, from Harry Potter to Twilight Saga. And then I also studied this series called The Amanda Project, which HarperCollins had launched, and they were almost trying to reverse engineer this kind of fandom. They asked young readers to contribute storylines on a website that then could be incorporated into future books in the series. So all of those things together went into my dissertation and then into my first book, Publishers, Readers, and Digital Engagement.
Wow. So that's, I mean, you think about how the digital platforms now have really enabled us to look like it's like a little window into the minds of readers and why
Absolutely.
they like what they do. Yeah, that's a gold mine.
Yeah, it really is. For someone, if you think about the marketing department at a publishing company, you know, in the past, how would a marketing department reach young people? I mean, you could have a postcard campaign, you could have a poster, but there was pretty limited ways of engaging young people or reaching them. And now you have a website and you can, you know, there's some other issues with that, of course, about permissions and moderation and all of those things. But just to be able to see what young people are interested in is so visible and so clear. And certainly, like with Harry Potter, you know, all those young people who made their own Harry Potter fan sites online, and how many kids learn how to, you know, code in HTML because they wanted to make a Harry Potter fan site, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was thinking about this really also shows what, you know, I mentioned as your prime interest, this interrelation where, you know, you've got the readers and the publishers and the authors, and they're all interested in each other.
Oh,
And
yeah.
that's not a one-way flow of
No.
you know, interaction there.
Right. Then, of course, we have the problem with corporate ownership, but I think that comes
Oh,
down to
yeah.
a later question. Yeah.
So, do you consider yourself a fan as well as a scholar of fandom, Marianne?
So that's a really complicated question too, because I think first to answer it, we have to look at how do we define fan, right? If we look at the definition, like look, pulled up Merriam-Webster. Merriam-Webster says that a fan is an enthusiastic devotee, usually a spectator, an ardent admirer or enthusiast. But then, you know, we also have, if we talk about Harry Potter fandom, then we also, you know, have this participatory part as well that comes into that. So I think there's much more of a community aspect in that. And then we have Henry Jenkins, who talks about being an ACA fan, an academic fan. And I would say that I'm somewhere in between. What I'm really most interested in all of this, while I did absolutely love the books and the movies and everything else, and you know, I've been to the Warner Studio in London, and you know, as part of my research, and I've been to Universal Studios. So I've had like a lot of experiences, and obviously I've been to some of the festivals and studied them. But what I'm really interested in is I'm really interested in the fans of Harry Potter. So I don't know what that would be called.
You're a fan of the
So
fans.
I'm a fan of the
You're
fans.
a
I'm a
meta
meta
fan.
fan. Yeah. I think that's a whole new term there we came up with.
It. I know some
Oh.
other meta fans, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to enjoy that. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I think that would be exactly the way to describe how I feel about everything.
That's so cool. Well, since you're a Meta fan, maybe you're the best person to tell us. How would you characterize the Harry Potter fandom and what makes it distinct from other fan communities?
Well, I think a lot of it with Harry Potter specifically is it's about the young people. So when I think about other fandoms, there's a lot of, you were talking about, we were talking about Tolkien before we started the podcast. And, I think there's a lot of adults who get into that or Star Trek or Star Wars. But I think there's this playful participation in the fandom and passionate engagement. That's not to say there aren't adult fans of Harry Potter, because of course there are. And the whole thing with forever fandom, people being fans for a very long time. But I do think there's this thing with the kids. It's led by the kids. And then this whole idea of the generation, the Harry Potter generation. I would also say that the internet has really a lot to do with Harry Potter fandom. And, if you think about, the internet, I mean, I think I had an Amazon account in 1995. I was kind of early with Amazon. But it was the if Harry Potter was published in the US in 1998, and fanfiction.net started in 1998, and more people had access to internet in their homes around that time as well, and people became interested in, learning HTML, learning basic coding stuff, and just being online. So I think that this idea of having this participatory element through the internet was really unusual with Harry Potter, like from the beginning. So, and then that exchange, fans being able to communicate directly with the author across social media channels, I don't think that had existed in quite the same way before. So for something of this size, this fandom of the size that, the Harry Potter fandom has grown into, the internet having fans create being able to communicate with each other, with the author, and ultimately even with the owners of the various products through the Pottermore site, for example. So there were just, even though, and of course we I can't say all of this without saying that Rowling was really against a lot of this from the beginning. There were a lot of lawsuits going on. She wasn't a fan of the fan site. She wasn't a fan of the fan fiction. I think she changed her stance on that at one point. And whether it's because she realized, how much support was coming from those kinds of venues. But initially it was very problematic. And then I would also say that a big thing with Harry Potter fandom is the very big non-commercial aspect of participatory Harry Potter fandom. And I mean, I've looked, of course, a lot at online fan fiction. I've looked at, we can't call them Harry Potter fests anymore, but those community-sponsored events like we had here in Kent, Ohio, where we had the, it's now called the Wizarding World of Kent, but also through libraries, through bookstores, kids just getting dressed up and lining up and showing up for a new release of a book, those kinds of things. And oh, young people making their own fan-related content, whether it's, making their own outfits or making badges or, different things at the library, for example, in schools probably. All those kinds of things together, I think was, really, I really love studying that stuff, the non-commercial angles of that.
So much of that does, also come into the commercial, like, Barnes and Noble has its book launch and people are encouraged to come in costume and, that there, that again, there is that, there's that mutual flow. And I have to say also, like, as a historian, I'm just delighted that you're connecting the characteristics of the fandom into, like, broader contextual historical changes in the way people are communicating at this. Right, I think that's so interesting that that Harry Potter has that. And I was also interested, you talk about this some in your book, that Harry Potter, if you compare it with some of the other fandoms like Twilight, you just see that there's so much more activity coming through the Harry Potter fandom. You have some really interesting charts that illustrate that it just it's something that was so participatory. It was so that's what made it such a phenomenon.
Yeah. And the Twilight Saga site, the Hachette owned one, that eventually got shut down, I think, because that was at the same time when publishers realized if we're going to do these websites, we have to hire moderators
Right.
because there was some really nasty content in that site and stuff that really wasn't great for the series. So obviously a publisher is not going to be behind something that is, criticizing a series and whatever else. Obviously publishers can do that and they can do it really, really well. But the idea of fans wanting to do it, that was something that, you know, there were certainly independent Twilight Saga fan sites as well. But I just don't think it has the continuity that Harry Potter does or did, or, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. But, you know, certainly Harry Potter has lasted so much longer.
Yeah. Now, you've talked about J.K. Rowling as a branded author. And the Harry Potter fans are branded readers. What does that mean? And how do these roles influence the community that's being built there?
Well, so if we talk about, you know, having branded authors, that's certainly nothing new, because if you think about, you know, going back to history, we think about, you know, Nancy Drew, who wasn't one person, but was part of the Stratemeyer Syndicate, but having this brand of Nancy Drew books, or having the brand of Babysitter Club books or Goosebumps. Those are very clearly branded series. And J.K. Rowling with the Harry Potter books fits into that kind of mold. There were, you know, seven books. So as part of that, there is that Harry Potter brand that is strongly tied to J.K. Rowling.
And the idea there is, I think, right, that when you pull a J.K. Rowling book off the shelf, you have a certain set of expectations that come with that brand.
Absolutely. In fact, like the other books that she's written under the pseudonym Robert Galbraith, is it?
That's right.
The adult books that she's written. And it's, she almost had to do that, because if people see an adult book, for example, by J.K. Rowling, they're going to think it's an adult book about, you know, somehow this, you know, Harry Potter world, and there's going to be a Hogwarts, and there's going to be Hermione. And, you know, so I think she almost had to have another name for herself in order to publish something that was going to be different. So with the readers becoming branded as well, there's a scholar called Tiziana Terranova who writes about immaterial and effective labor. And her theory has shaped so much of my work. So when I talk about immaterial labor, that's labor that is done freely, that is not paid. And the effective part is because it's done out of love for the series in this case. So labor that's just done for free without pay, and the effective quality just is all about their love of the series and the world that Rowling has built. So when readers then participate in all of this stuff and they're doing marketing for the publisher, then they're part of this brand extension as well. So that's kind of how I saw the branded reader.
Yeah. And you know, I often think that when I see these fan productions, I think, how much time do people put into making these videos that are pretty slick and super clever with the lyrics and the, and like that, like that's a lot of time invested in these, you know, these fan creations.
That's interesting.
And I like that idea that it's affective labor. I think that makes a lot of sense. I can see that.
It's the only way this would get done, right? I mean, you couldn't pay anyone to create this kind of stuff, right? I mean, if you said, okay, I'm hiring this junior marketing person and he or she is going to, you know, do all of this stuff, there's no way that they would be as invested in it as someone who just loves it so much and, you know, wants the social cultural capital of participating in this way too, right?
Yeah. And I think it does mean that you can tell the quality is higher when the people have a real love for the series and the characters and all of that. Yeah,
for sure.
And so when we think about that in terms of, we've got the branded author rolling, we've got branded readers, you know, performing this affective labor. How does that affect the relationship between the community and that original author?
So I think that comes into ownership a little bit. That's where we start to have a little bit of this push-pull thing, because I'm sure the author, you know, I think any author would think it was awesome to have this community of readers around a book that they've created or a series that they've created. But then we also get into this idea of ownership, because, you know, if we have these fans who are creating websites, videos, fan fiction, and it's infringing on copyright in some cases, or seemingly infringing on copyright, that's problematic for a corporation, whether it's a publisher or Warner or whomever. So there's definitely that sort of legal issue and ownership issue that starts to happen. I would say that fans have an enormous feeling of ownership with the Harry Potter series. And I think that, you know, if you've grown up with these books and you had a book coming out almost every year of your childhood and then the movies and everything else, and you've been following this and participating in this all along, you somehow do feel like this belongs to you a little bit. And if you're a fan fiction writer, you certainly feel very much an ownership. I mean, I love, there's a scholar called Lauren Camachi.
Oh yeah, we've had her on the show.
We know Lauren well.
I was so delighted to see that she was referenced in your book. She's awesome. Yeah,
she is awesome.
I love what she says about, you know, the levels of canon. And she talks about, you know, the first level of canon with Harry Potter is the books, right? And then alt canon is the movies, and para canon is, you know, playing on Jeanette's concept of paratext, which is all the Harry Potter stuff. And then the fanon, which is fan related content. And then the meta canon, which is J.K. Rowling's updates. But this idea of the fanon, fan related content, I mean, that's like, they're very serious about that. Don't mess with that. Mm-hmm. And the fans are certainly really mad when, you know, J.K. Rowling, in some cases, if you're a fan fiction writer and, you know, you've just developed some, you know, ships in your fan fiction, and all of a sudden Rowling updates and says, oh, hey, by the way, Dumbledore was gay. And, you know, all these other things are changing in the books. You know, that's really problematic.
Yeah. So what about you know, McGonagall Dumbledore shipping?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then, I mean, I haven't even said anything about like how fans felt when, you know, they're not allowed to have Potter fests. But
yes. Yeah. So, then, you know, what's interesting, Marianne, I was sort of thinking about this. I was sort of the moderator on a panel about copyright at the Roanoke Harry Potter Fest. And I sort of, as we actually had some lawyers on the panel, and I had not really thought about this part of it before, but I'm sure this is part of that legal issue you were talking about. It's a very real thing that if you let people use the, you know, the names and the peculiar words, you know, Hogwarts or Slytherin, if you let people use that enough without protesting it, you lose your rights to it. And so they do have to try to corral that to some degree so that it doesn't just become like, you know, Kleenex, you know, or Xerox, that just doesn't have, is not, that loses its trademark.
Don't you feel like, though, that that's just going to be an ongoing battle as long as this fandom exists? Because I think, you know, it's just, there's just going to be certain things that you're always going to sort of, you're always going to talk about a Harry Potter fandom or, you know, hopefully we'll see what happens with all of that. But I do think that there's terms from the universe that Rowling created that are part of the everyday vernacular now that, you know, have sort of slid in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you
in a
think
similar
about
way, to the generational, you know, appeal of Star Wars and how, you know, this has been a shared text that people share across generations in their own family. And, you know, it's difficult to see all that as, I mean, I guess that's the question I'm left with, like, who does own, you know, Harry Potter? I mean, how do we understand, like, what's the short answer here to who owns Harry Potter?
Well, I mean, the legal answer is that, like, the books, J.K. Rowling would own the books. And then, you know, in some cases, like the films or the amusement park, I believe it's Warner Brothers. And then in a third, it's Rowling and Warner. So now J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World is now a trademark of J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers. And that's what the Pottermore site has now become. So, I mean, I think that there's some crossovers there and some back and forth. And clearly when she agreed to the movies, you know, then she loses some ownership by handing it off to Warner. And she has had amazing and impressive control over the Harry Potter franchise, like no other author, by the way. So, you know, in addition to setting precedents for our fandoms, I think that we also have to talk about Rowling's precedents for authorship, particularly when we think about this as really a children's project, right? Because traditionally, children's literature is kind of marginalized in the field of publishing, right? So, like, you know, you have the big publishers and people coming out of college, they want to be editorial assistants at Random House or Knopf or whatever they want to do. But, you know, children's literature is sort of like, there's those who are really passionate about it. But most of the time, it's like, well, I'd really rather be on the adult side of things, you know? So the fact that, you know, the Harry Potter books were on the New York Times bestseller list over and over and over again, until the point that the New York Times created a children's bestseller list because they needed to, you know, have adult books on the bestseller list as well, as more and more of books in the series came out. So first of all, she's had that kind of power, right? But then just with the franchise itself. So and I'm not sure if this is still the case, but for Wizarding World, because when I looked at this, it was Pottermore. But if you wanted to buy, for example, an ebook version of the books on Amazon, you couldn't. You had to go to Pottermore to buy them. And so Amazon receives a reduced fee. So, and it's also about controlling how books can be used and shared and all these kinds of things. So when purchased through the Pottermore site, the books were available without DRM, digital rights management, so readers could read the books across multiple devices. So that's something that she was able to control, which is not about making more money, but just about allowing more readers to access the books. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to be able to make a dent in Amazon, like who can do that, right?
Yeah. And it's so interesting because I think in a way, I think that the, you know, that Warner Brothers was able to kind of market the fact that Rowling had a lot of control over what the movies were going to look like, yep, to reassure fans that this, yeah, these will be movies that you will want to see. We're not going to break your trust. You know, we're not going to rewrite these because J.K. Rowling is right here and she's managing, yeah, the process. So it actually worked for them in a way.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's super unusual, right? I mean, usually you sell movie rights to a book series and goodbye, right? It's gone. Yeah. And even like her own public appearances, you know, she really does have a lot of control over her public appearances and where the money goes. And, you know, now we, mm-hmm, all know that she's very famous for donating to all these charitable causes. And she set this example that many other authors are now following in her path. So,
Yeah, very interesting. Well, Emily and I have both participated in these Potterfests that you've been talking,
yeah,
about. And
yes,
the Roanoke Harry Potter Festival that I mentioned, which was actually at the beginning of our podcasting adventures together, Emily,
yes,
if you remember that.
Fond memories.
And also, you mentioned the Roanoke Harry Potter Festival, which had to change its name, and it changed its,
yeah,
name kind of cheekily to Generic Magic,
yes,
Festival.
Yes.
But then also we've been to the Chestnut Hill, Pennsylvania Festival as well. And you talk in your book quite a bit about these Potter Fests. What's kind of unique about these particular, you know, expressions of the fandom?
I think they were like my favorite thing to study, honestly, because, yeah, and it was so fun, you know, that we had one in Kent in 2016, right around the time that I was, even before, like I'd started thinking about writing this book. In 2016, Kent decided to do this, the city of Kent, Ohio, decided to do this. I'm going to call it Potterfest, but we're not allowed to call it that anymore. You know that. So, they started and they got 10,000 people. Now, Kent is a pretty small city here in Northeast Ohio. It's like a city of 30,000 people when school isn't in session. And then we have a lot more when they're students. But they just sort of put things on Facebook and people got, all the stores in town got really excited and sort of had little makeovers and decorations, and the whole city got involved. It was so cute. And it was held on, you know, Harry Potter's birthday in July. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Nice touch.
Yes, of course. And so all the stores were selling all kinds of things and a lot of licensed merchandise. So you could buy Harry Potter's, the beans, the spacing on what.
Yeah.
Called.
The Bertie Bott's every flavor.
Bertie Bott's magic.
Yeah.
Beans. Yeah.
The Jelly Bellies. Yeah.
Exactly. All those kinds of things were being sold all over, wands and licensed merchandise. Of course, it sold out so fast. Mm-hmm. Bars were making specialized drinks. Coffee shops were making butter beer. Everyone was making something. And it was like a whole town festival. The library got involved. They had, you know, the banned books from the library. They had books that were recommended by different characters. Super cute. And, you know, books on, you know, therapy for certain, you know, Luna Lovegood had some other kind of recommendations. It was really, really adorable. So the whole town was involved. There was a run. You could play Quidditch. You could play chess. You could do all kinds of things, right? And then the next year, they're like, oh, that was a huge success. Let's do it again. So they started advertising on Facebook. And the organizers got really nervous when they suddenly saw there were like 20,000 people commenting on the Facebook page.
Wow.
And then, yeah, Warner Brothers saw it too. So, mm-hmm, they got a cease and desist letter. And then in 2018, it was renamed the Wizarding World of Kent. But they still had, you know, they had all the shops selling the merchandise, Wizardly Creations, a lot of handmade stuff, local craftspeople making things. So fun. And all these things that I really think keep Harry Potter alive and well in the public imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And you also saw all these families coming with their kids and bringing their kids. So it's like Harry Potter fan 2.0, right? When people's kids were showing up in costume and everything else. So just all of those things were, it was just so, so lovely. And then of course, now we've had the pandemic. So who knows what's going to happen next. But
yeah. And you know, I was thinking about what you were saying about almost too many people wanting, maybe I should take the almost out of that, because I know Chestnut Hill also experienced that, where they were picked up by, I don't know, it was some big, was it like the Boston Globe, or I can't remember. There was some
or something like that.
Oh yeah. Huffington Post. That's what it was. And so they got an enormous quantity of people who descended on this little town.
I mean, people sending me Facebook messages about it and saying, have you heard about this? And I'm like, yeah, I've been going for the last 3 years. Like, how did you just hear about it? You
know? Right, yeah, right. But it was, yeah. And then, and so then you have people trying to plan for these, you know, this massive turnout. I want to say the Roanoke Harry Potter Festival, the first time we did it, Emily, was also had a lot of people.
It was mad.
A lot of people. Yes.
And it was like crowd crush situation. Yeah. You know, at certain times. Mm-hmm. I mean, like we remember we were scheduled like back to back, talks, you know, kind of academic talks. And it was like really difficult to get from one talk to the next because of the crowds in the common spaces. It was nuts.
But you'd have 100 people signed up to come to an academic talk about Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Wow.
I talked about Quidditch in a theater. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, it was super exciting, just really exhilarating to be a part of, but also like, you have to remember that these are often like Kent, the small towns who are planning it. And it's not a big corporation. These are not people who do, you know, party planning and that kind of thing is their business. And so, you know, when fans come and they're like, there aren't enough porta potties. It's like, well,
exactly.
We didn't know there were going to be 40,000 people at this thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was involved in a crowd crush, literally a crowd crush in downtown Chestnut Hill that year where it exploded and you know, 40,000 people showed up or whatever. And we were so thick with each other in the middle of the, you know, the downtown little strip in Chestnut Hill that the crowd just stopped. Were like, oh my gosh, my friend Kat and I always attend together. And we were like, oh my gosh, what happens now? Fortunately, there were businesses that lined the strip that just started open, like ones that were not open yet, like restaurants that were not open yet. They just started opening their doors and letting people through and kind of alleviating the crush. And it slowly just dissipated. But if that had not happened sort of organically, it was a really pretty scary situation. It was certainly was not a place where I was like, wow, I wish I would have brought my small child.
Right.
Kent had something similar.
Yeah. The second year that they had it, it was totally the crowd crush. It was half an hour to get a bottle of water, and it was a really, really hot day. Uh-huh. And they were not equipped for that. And how could you be, right?
Right.
Right. And, you know, since then, I mean, we should say that, they have gone to more generic magic festivals and but there's, you know, and they do things like you were pointing out, some of them, they slightly change some of the Hogwarts house names in ways that, you know, you still know what you're doing, you still know who Slytherin is, but they're calling it the serpents. That's right, the serpents.
House of Serpents.
And also I think that the attendance started to go way down after that as well, which is a little bit of a shame, but it is a little more manageable that way.
Well, yeah, something has to change, obviously. That's totally clear, right? But I still feel that like some of that organic fandom that happens, and that love for the series, and that, you know, people were driving like from out of state to come to the Kent Potter Fest. I mean, which is good and bad, because the city is kind of too small and wasn't quite prepared the second year for that kind of crush. The third year they were, you know, they had organized things better. They had closed streets, which they hadn't done. And so the flow was much better, but still it's just a really tricky thing. But I think like sometimes like all this legal, you know, no one wants to be sued by Warner Brothers. City of Kent definitely doesn't want to be sued by Warner. Nobody does. And so I think that puts a huge damper on this kind of stuff.
And I love the way that people do things, like they make their own wands and then you can go and you can buy a wand, you know, and the little like versions of butterbeer and all those kinds of things, I think are so much, they're so much fun. And it's so nice to see that creativity, you know, that I feel like is pretty innocent. And then to feel like it's just, you know, this kind of legal anvil that comes down on top of you.
Right.
What do you think has been the impact of these sort of cease and desist notices on the fandom? And you know, where do you think this is going to go in the future?
Well, I think that it's definitely a concern. And when I titled the book Forever Fandom, I was writing about, you know, this sort of thing, because I had just, you know, had gone to the Warner Brothers studio tour, and I had seen, you know, all these people and in the gift store, they're buying onesies for their babies. And, you know, this idea of passing this fandom on to the next generation, like loving it so much your whole life, and then wanting to share it with your children and passing it on. I just thought was this really, really magical thing about the series, right? Like just continuing like that and just having something that you enjoyed so much that you want your kids to experience that. And certainly I saw that at the Kent Potter Fest too, you know, this idea of sharing the series and everything else. I think that the cease and desist stuff is no joke. And I think that all of the festivals that I had studied as I was writing this book are probably all rethinking what they're doing with this. Do you know, is Roanoke continuing?
I don't think they've had it the last couple of years, mostly because of COVID.
Right, right. So COVID kind of provided this weird natural break to sort of reevaluate and reconsider. And I don't know what Kent's going to do. They did have an event last summer, but it was really low key. And I think it was just, you know, I wasn't there, so I didn't attend it, but it was definitely not like a 20,000 people kind of event.
Yeah. And the Stanton, Virginia one, that's the Queen City Magic and Mischief, right, yeah. Emily? I think they moved to doing a lot of online things during COVID, but they did try to kind of keep doing it at least to some degree to, you know, to try to keep some continuity in that. But it's been, I mean, obviously COVID, the breaks that were created by COVID extend, you know, farther than that, but it definitely had its impact on these festivals for sure.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think so. You talked about some of the commercial things like wand making workshops, something they had in Kent, but we took my younger son to Universal Studios to see the Harry Potter world when he was 12. And we just dropped my older son off. He was going abroad for study abroad for a year. And we sort of, as consolation, took our younger son to Universal. And he was all set. His friends had been there the year before and they had bought wands at the store. And he was so excited to participate in the whole thing with, you know, the being chosen by your wand and everything. And we went into the store and there was, of course, throngs of people in there. And there was the person selling wands did his spiel, and then one person was selected, you know, with this particular wand, and then everybody else could go into the store. And my son picked up this box and, you know, he had his $40 saved. I think it was $40 for a wand. And he was examining the wands and he turned one over and he saw the Made in China sticker on the bottom. And it was like the spell was broken.
Oh.
He was done.
Ha.
Oh my gosh.
Interesting.
Like, good for him.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, there's something about if he had made a wand at a workshop, it wouldn't have been that same thing. It would have been a wand that he had made. Right. But like going to the store and being told you have to spend all your carefully saved money on something made in China, it was, his eyes were like wide open and he was crushed. It was so sad.
Aww. Yeah. It takes you out of it. I can totally see that.
Totally.
Breaking the spell is exactly what it does. It sort of reminds you that this is an industrially produced, mass marketed product.
Right.
Right. And not magical.
I even like I've definitely bought my share of wands that were, you know, like local craftspeople who make wands and they decorate them.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a little magic to them and they're
absolutely
unique. They're one of a kind. And they have the kind of love of the handmade. And
totally agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now I got somebody made me aware of a local woodcrafting shop that was doing Valentine's Day events where you turn your own wand on a lathe and you can come with your sweetheart who you probably grew up reading Harry Potter with and you can turn your own wands as a little Valentine's Day date. And he was like, you should do this. And I was like, oh my gosh, my husband would, that would not be the right the activity for us for Valentine's Day.
Not his thing. Okay.
Not his thing. And also, we already each all have, we're armed. We're already armed. We have multiple wands, yeah. Multiple lightsabers. We're all good.
Would he lose a finger, Emily? Is that what you're worried
Maybe.
About?
Maybe. I don't think it would be a good scene.
Oh, dear.
That's funny.
So in terms of the interplay between the fans and the authors, creators of the Harry Potter books, I would just say that one of the things also that's really interesting about how the fans have had a chance to shape the literature mm-hmm. and all of this around the wizarding world. And I think that the fans have been enormously powerful with this series, which is something that is so exciting to me. So Henry Jenkins, not Harry Potter, has written in 1999, he wrote about Heather Lover. This was all about wanting to shut down sites by Lover and young fans. And, there's a very famous article that Henry Jenkins has written about this and how Lover organized fans in this counter-strike, literally boycotting Potter merchandise in conjunction with the release of one of the movies. And it was known as the Potter Wars. And so that was like one example of a very vocal fan who had her own fan side and everything else. There were these like young tech savvy kids who were going to speak up about what they thought. And then there was the Harry Potter Alliance campaign, which literally changed how Harry Potter chocolates were made. Do you know about that one?
Oh yeah.
So cool. Right. Tell us about it though, Marianne, in case some listeners don't know.
Yeah. So it really changed how Harry Potter chocolate was made. There was this 4-year battle to make sure that only fair trade cocoa was sold in these Harry Potter chocolates. And even J.K. Rowling eventually signed the petition, which was exciting. And so they also made sure that it wasn't made with child labor, for example.
That is awesome.
So this idea of these fan activists was amazing.
Yeah. And I just want to note that one of the ways they did that was by sort of talking about the labor practices in the not fair trade chocolate in relation to house elves, which Emily and I are totally into house elf, empowerment and liberation, and the idea that we shouldn't be basically perpetuating slave systems exploitative labor systems like the house elves were exploited. And that makes such a powerful analogy that Harry Potter fans can get behind, and that it illuminates something that's happening in our own world and allows you to take action. That's what's so powerful about it.
Yeah, they're a tool for teaching and activism, really,
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole Harry Potter Alliance, which now is fandom forward for other reasons, but amazing. Like teaching young people activism. And I listened to your podcast on house elves and I loved it.
Awesome.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So no, I think that is, taking these examples from the books and using them is really great. And then the other thing is the Pottermore site. There was the whole Twitter rebellion around that. So, about when Pottermore at some point, I think around 2015, they decided that it would be a good idea to change the way the site was structured. So young people could no longer communicate with each other in site, and they could no longer play certain games. And within 48 hours of the relaunch, there were 5,000 tweets with fans complaining. And it was just, there was a whole hashtag, bring back old Pottermore. Mm-hmm. And there were posts from around the world complaining about this, which shows just how international the series is and the reach of all of this. But fans they felt robbed, and they couldn't find their badges and their memberships. Mm-hmm. One said he felt like he or she felt like he'd been expelled from Hogwarts. And so after that, they had to, they initiated this Pottermore correspondent who then would, allegedly listen to fans' comments and then respond to fans as the Pottermore correspondent. But I don't know how that in the end impacted the Pottermore site. And it's interesting. I haven't looked much at the Wizarding World site. Have you guys looked at that yet?
Yes. And I would say I really love the backstories. As the historian, like the history of the world there. And there's so much interesting like historical rhetoric coming through what's going on there that I think is like unexamined on Rowling's part. And you get new Rowling writings that way. But I find it quite slick. You know, it's very corporate. It's tied in very closely to the movies. And, and I don't see that there's much participatory, you know, you can still take the quiz to get your house and wand and a Patronus. And I think those things are fun. Like I definitely have done all of those things, but it's, it doesn't have, you know, in the other site, the earlier site, it was not that, it was clunky,
right.
You know, but people liked that about it. And then you have this like little homegrown feel to it and people can participate more and make it more their own space. And I definitely think the Wizarding World site is designed to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. And also to sort of, I think the name change probably has a lot to do with folding in the Fantastic Beasts series and other products that might emerge. Sure. Right?
Yeah. Oh, so yeah.
So it's an expansion in a way. And that was my initial read on it too.
Mm-hmm.
So Marianne, I have to ask, you mentioned Twitter earlier. And so I have to ask the question, you know, on a lot of people's minds, your book came out in 2018.
Right.
Before Rowling made her controversial comments about trans people, controversial and very insensitive, I will add.
Uh-huh.
How have those statements affected the fan community in the last couple of years?
Well, I think I know a lot of individual, you know, I've talked to a lot of scholars about this and, you know, we're all pretty dismayed about it. I don't know why she felt the need to speak out and then continue to hammer the point across. I don't really understand why she would need to do that, especially since I feel like the LGBTQ community in general has been so supportive of the Harry Potter series in so many different ways.
Yep.
I know when I spoke with people at Kent State from the Harry Potter Alliance here a few years back, you know, the woman at the time who I talked to, you know, she identified as a lesbian and she just said that she came from a really small town, Ohio, come to Kent State. And she said, just reading those books made her feel that there was a place for her in this world. I mean, you know, like just hearing something like that. Right. And
your book actually does talk a lot about the, you know, the proportion of fans who are in that LGBTQ plus realm and who do find solace and inspiration in the books. And, I think you quoted some statistics about the percentage of people within the Harry Potter Alliance who identified as, you know, LGBTQ plus somehow, and it's much higher than in the larger population. Absolutely, this is a huge core fan base. And I think just dismay is definitely a good word to describe, I think, the reaction.
Yeah, just unbelievable. And I just feel like the series would not be what it is today without the support of the fans, without the fan sites, without the fan engagement, without the festivals, without the homemade merchandise and all this stuff that keeps it alive in people's minds, whether you have money to participate or not. It doesn't even matter. Everyone can participate in this. And to really sort of squash a certain part of your you know, fan community, why would you do that? I don't understand.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the Harry Potter Alliance changed its name.
Yeah.
And they did that basically to separate themselves some from J.K. Rowling because
perhaps even this podcast that we're on right now may have made a move in that same direction, right?
Right, exactly.
We used to be Reading, Writing, Rowling, and even the name Rowling was very hard for people. And
including us,
yes,
yeah,
and we love the books and the world that she created. And I think Emily and I are in agreement on this, that I think that she is not embodying the values of that world
Absolutely. In
the things that she's doing. And so I think her books are a powerful antidote to exactly the kind of, you know, intransigence and kind of trying to put people in boxes thing that she's trying to do.
Fear-based ideology.
We still love the Harry Potter series and that magical world.
Right.
And so we wanted to focus on that and not on her. And so I think that was sort of our way of going forward. And I know a lot of fans have been in that situation, right? Where it's like, but I love the books. What do I do now? And it's been really tough.
One scholar I know, she said she will never again spend money on anything related to the series that makes money for the author. So she will, and she has a young son. So she will, you know, she has her own books, obviously, that she will share with her child, but she won't spend any money that in any way goes toward the author. That's her way of dealing with it, because she's a member of the Harry Potter generation and grew up with the books and studies the books and adores the series. And is also devastated about all of this that's been happening. But it's, again, it's about, you know, what's going to happen in the future. Will fans be able to separate the series and the content from its creator? It's something that we're dealing with all the time lately, it seems, you know, Bill Cosby, Woody Allen, Michael Jackson, you know, and can we actually do that? And then, you know, also there's the whole thing with, she seems to continue to enforce this stance because, and then, you know, there's, you know, the collective conscious, how long will people remember that she said these things in 2020, but she keeps going. So it seems like her own worst enemy in this whole thing.
Right. And I'll give my read on her personality that I think is what's creating this problem. She just has a really strong sense that what she thinks is correct.
Yeah.
And she is, once she has decided something, she is not open to additional information. She's not listening anymore. And I think that is the core problem, that she is not listening anymore. And she's done this on other issues too, when she got a lot of pushback for the way that she talked about, you know, Native Americans on her Pottermore essays.
The Ilvermorny.
She had no response to that. And it's because I don't think she's not listening, and she's not willing to make a change like that. And there's a kind of obstinate core there. And I think in some ways we liked that when it was strong in the face of like core moral values that we agreed with.
Right.
But now it's, you know, she needs to have open ears. So this is how I think about, like, I'm learning a lot. Like, I'm still, my ears are open, and I know I don't have all the answers, but I think she feels like she does. And that's why I think she keeps at it. And it's really, it's distressing to a lot of people. And I don't even mean just in the fandom. It's definitely had a huge, you know, cataclysmic effect within the fandom itself, though.
I mean, I was aware of the Ilvermorny discussion around the time that I was writing the book, and was really appalled by that, and you know, just the whole appropriation and the making up things related to a tribe that doesn't exist, and, you know, all this really disgusting kind of stuff. And then, you know, the transgender stuff on top of that. Yeah, it's really a lot.
And but I think if she could show that she was that, oh, well, I put that out there and I didn't realize, right?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can adjust. Can I, you know, issue an apology? Can I adjust? Can I talk about how I'm still thinking, you know, I'm still learning? Yeah. And
can I make some overtures to people in this community to help me understand?
Yes.
It would be easy to do that. And she seems so unwilling.
It's not in her personality to do it. That's my read.
I think that's true. I think she doesn't care.
I think it's the shadow side of somebody with a big vision and a big you know, set of core beliefs, that obstinacy, if that's a word, is what got her published, you know, what got her book to the public in the first place. But at the same time, that has a shadow side that I do agree, Katie, with your assessment that we're seeing that in some of these issues.
Yeah, I agree too. But I also think you're right. And the world that she built, like, she had to have like that kind of clear vision about her world, the Harry Potter universe. And I think that was what upset her about the fandom as well, like making their own related stories. And she would just be like, no, that's not what happens. And that's not that way. And this is my story, and that's it. So there's only one story. And maybe that's sort of the way she's thinking about this. There's only one story about this, and it's my story, and I don't care what you have to say.
Yeah. Again, it's this ownership battle.
Right.
Yeah. So thinking about all this, Marianne, what do you think is in the future for Harry Potter fandom from this point forward?
Well, I do think it's kind of problematic. I think, you know, when I wrote the book, I would have thought this is going to just go on and on and on. And, you know, 2017, 2018, when I was writing it, this was
forever
a good time.
Fandom. It's forever, forever
fandom. Exactly. So, you know, she still has 14 million followers on Twitter. And I mean, I still follow her because I want to know what she's doing next. I feel like we need to follow her. So I don't know how many of those right. people are following her from a critical standpoint or not. Actually, I think I'm just, I don't think I clicked the button to follow her, but I do sort of keep an eye on what she's doing. But she, I did look just before I was talking to you to see, and 14 million is a lot of followers on Twitter. So, you know, there people really love the series. Are people going to be able to separate the series from the person who that whose politics they may or may not agree with? I think that's going to be the determinant in the end, if this is to go on. And also I think, you know, I think there's maybe been too much of a smackdown from the corporate world on these festivals. And because I really believe that that organic creativity is what kept the series alive and and thriving so many years after publication at this point, and really sort of have turned it into a classic. It's almost like a modern day classic, right?
Yes.
It's part of the children's literature canon already. We have to say that, right?
Yes.
So, so what do we do? You know, what do we do about this, this book and the problematic author? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that kids are still going to be picking up the series. I'm not sure anymore, because how are they going to hear about it? How, you know, it's just going to be, who knows, right? Like, if they're not allowed to have these festivals that otherwise would advertise it to kids who can't afford to go to Universal Studios or to the Warner Studio Tour or to whatever else that costs a lot of money, how is it going to be kept in people's minds in that same way?
Yeah. And I always think, you know, like the Lord of the Rings fandom, I always think we could, we can learn from it because it's been around for longer and there's a kind of maturity to that. And it's not like Tolkien had a lot of ideas that we would have agreed, we would agree with today. And, you know, sort of people trying to separate out the world from the author. I think that, you know, that community is also struggling with some of those things and has done. And that's something that, you know, might be, you know, a model in some way for how we might think about the Harry Potter fandom going forward.
Yeah. And that the Tolkien fandom is really, really is going through some dark, I mean, and maybe I'm thinking more of Tolkien scholarship. They're going through some dark days this time, findings, and maybe I shouldn't even get into it, 'cause I don't, I'm just like reading it on the surface, but there are racial tensions. I will say that, there are racial tensions, and some of that is affecting that fandom right now, and that scholarly fandom. But I always think Star Wars, I mean, I'm a fan of the Disney era of Star Wars. You know, it's not my favorite, but, in terms of content, some of it, but I love the way they're making a lot of strong efforts to be as inclusive as possible. And I really appreciate that as well, coming from the corporate entity, you know, in terms of even, you know, not allowing people, actors, you know, and creators who want to say, you know, kind of extremist things or hold, you know, positions that are not supported by data, and being public about that, they're not letting those people participate in the creation of Star Wars anymore either. And whether you want to call that cancel culture or whether you want to call that accountability, which is, I kind of see it as more accountability in that situation. I think that's also something that we can look to for guidance, you know, in terms of the Harry Potter fandom and how to proceed.
Yeah. I mean, and they've had their issues as well, I think, you know, with not including Rey and the initial like little action figure set.
What was with that?
I know. Then there, I think there was some, you know, discussion of the African-American stormtrooper. And, you know, I these are just struggles that we're having right now in our whole culture. And it's depressing.
Well,
I just hope we'll,
end
up in a better place. Better place at the end. Yeah.
Right. And I think there is something in the culture now about holding authors to a higher standard. And we expect this. We expect it of someone like Rowling, right? Because her books are all about, you know, creating opportunity for all in many ways, right? And everyone has a place. And, you know, there's all these great values. And even like her canon revisions, you know, with Dumbledore being gay and Hermione being Black and things like that, in a way, made it look like she was more open to a different standard.
Yes.
And so that was why this was so shocking, the way she came down to me anyway. It just seemed like this was the antithesis of what she'd been promoting before. So, and it's not to say that the books were super inclusive, because they're not. And there's, you know, and the same with the movies. But, you know, some of these revisions made it seem like she was interested in, I don't know, in sort of improving some of that. But
yeah, I know. It has. I have actually welcomed the opportunity to look harder at the series itself for the ways in which it promotes, you know, equality and inclusivity, and for the ways that have been really helpfully pointed out to me by some great, you know, scholars, in the ways that it doesn't, you know, the ways that it falls short, well short of that, and actually is a kind of a more traditional text.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have huge problems with, I mean, Hermione should be the star of the show in my view, you know, I mean, she's always saving the day. She's the one with the brains behind everything in my view. So I don't know. I feel like, yeah, she sort of, she gets to be sort of the right hand person, but, you know,
To these guys who just have to battle it out with their wands. You know, it's like another story about two men battling out with sticks.
Absolutely. And the whole thing with, you know, having, I mean, there's a tradition in publishing about that boys will read stories about boys, girls will read stories about boys, but boys won't read stories about girls. And then the fact that her name, that she went with the initials, J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
That's a traditional thing to mask your gender in order to have a wider audience.
I'm not sure that that's even true. My sons will definitely read stories with female protagonists.
Yeah.
I really think it's changing.
I think it's always been the case, but I think that there was, when I worked in publishing, there was this whole thing. I mean, we had all these books, like I translated this one book and I was like, can we just make it a girl in English? And I was totally fought on that one. You know, this is in the 90s. So there was this perception about that. So I don't know that the data backs up the perception, but you can certainly see a lot of books with male characters. So,
thank you so much, Marianne. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, indeed.
Thank you guys so much. It was so fun revisiting all of this. And it's just, you know, sometimes you write a book and you have no idea what happens to it when you send it out into the world. So thank you for finding it and reading it and inviting me to speak with you today.
Absolutely. And I think you really have helped us to kind of understand the fandom that we're a part of at a deeper level. And I'm definitely thinking about it in new ways. So I really appreciate that.
Well, right back at you. So thank you for what I've learned today as well.
Oh, wonderful. So our closing quote today speaks to the power of shared struggles, which I think we in the Harry Potter fandom can relate to. And it comes from the Sorcerer's Stone. There are some things you can't share without ending up liking each other. And knocking out a 12-foot mountain troll is one of them. May we keep shoving our wands up the trolls' noses in defense of our friends. Metaphorically speaking, of course.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time. Class dismissed.